What I want to do is, just like with Screwtape Letters, I kind of want to put this in a gospel perspective. Screwtape Letters is all about, are you aware of your weakness? Are you aware where Satan is going to come to attack? I think that's a very important part of the gospel. But the great divorce to me is where I wanted to end, because every temple that we've ever had on any stage of the earth, way back in Old Testament times, every temple shows our progression through terrestrial, and celestial. This is the tabernacle of Moses. This outer courtyard was kind of considered the telestial world. As you travel through the telestial world, you meet the altar of sacrifice. You wash with the laver. And then you can enter into the holy place, which is symbolic of a terrestrial world. You leave the telestial and enter terrestrial. And then there are different images, symbols that help guide you out of the terrestrial and into the celestial. So even anciently, temples are a progression from telestial to terrestrial to celestial. And then if you go to modern temples, anyone been down to Manti to see the open house? The beautiful thing about the original temples, Salt Lake, the four original temples, Salt Lake, Logan, St. George, and Manti, is they had physical rooms that you moved around. This is the telestial room in the celestial temple, in the Salt Lake Temple. Now, I want you to see the symbolism of that. We've got to stop, and we can't think telestial kingdom. This is not the telestial kingdom. Telestial kingdom is a kingdom of glory many years from now. This is the telestial world. And every single one of you have to navigate through the telestial world. You turn on your television, there's the telestial world. You can invite the telestial world into you through your AirPods, through your headphones, through your television set, through your radio. All you have to do is walk around and you will see elements of the telestial world. They live the telestial law in the telestial world. The invitation is to exit. Now, the beautiful thing about the original temples, notice, in order to exit the telestial room, I go up. I always go up. If you are willing to let go. Now, how many telestial things can I take out of that room and take with me? Heavenly Father does not determine what kingdom of glory you go to. It is not his to assess, as much as it's simply, if you will not leave the telestial world, it's pretty obvious which kingdom to put you in. There's the exit. Walk out. But you cannot take anything telestial with you. You have to let go of everything telestial, or you stay in that room. And he is begging you upward and onward. He won't force you, but you cannot leave that room unless you let go. That is the heart and soul of the gospel message. There are three laws, three worlds, three kingdoms. If you live by the law of the telestial world and hold on to telestial things, you have a telestial kingdom to inherit. Anyone who wants out of that room is free to leave. But you can't take anything telestial with you. Now, once you leave, we enter the terrestrial room. And in the Salt Lake Temple, In the Manti temple, in many of our early temples, it was a separate room. You leave and enter the terrestrial room. It's beautiful. That's a stunningly beautiful room. And it is filled with terrestrial things, all of which are good, honorable things. But the invitation is to come up the stairs, to come up those stairs through the veil and into the greatest room in the Salt Lake Temple. Come into the celestial. Anyone who wants to can come in. But if you're going to come in, you have to leave everything that's terrestrial behind. You cannot take anything with you. So he just simply stands at the door and says, come, come. And everyone who lets go of everything terrestrial comes into his kingdom. It is not going to be very hard to figure out which kingdom of glory everyone goes to. He just has to go to the room that you find yourself in. Those of you who have not and cannot let go of terrestrial things, he has a kingdom for you. But there's the door. There's the door, right there. Come. Come. Just let go of everything terrestrial. Now, I don't know how C.S. Lewis caught that idea, but he wrote an entire book on that premise, letting go. Now, he does not distinguish between terrestrial and telestial. That'll be our job as we read through it. But the idea is, can you let go? Can you let go? Tim.
The newer temples, are they separate rooms?
No.
Why?
Convenience. Getting more people in.
You can be in
the telestial room and not be part of it. I mean, I can be surrounded by it and not participate it. I don't let go. I don't have to participate because I'm surrounded by it. It's what's in my heart, in my head. What do I look at with my eyes? What do I think about in my head? And that's the challenge. How do you live in a telestial world with telestial things all around you and then let go of them? So here's the idea. Chapters 1, 2, and 3, you just kind of have to plow through because it's the beginning of the story. It's a bunch of people at a bus stop waiting for a bus. Now, what we find out later is that this is hell. And these are people getting on a bus to exit hell and go on vacation to heaven. They're all on the bus, and they're going to take this bus to heaven. And the first couple of chapters are just all the bickering and everything that you would expect to find with a group of ghosts from hell as they get on a bus. Now, when the bus gets to heaven, every one of them are told, all right, let's get to the great divorce. As soon as the bus gets to heaven, oh, come on. If we jump to chapter 3, as soon as they get to heaven, every one of them, the question is, hi, mister, said the big man, addressing the driver, when have we got to be back? You need never come back unless you want to. He replied, stay as long as you please. So this bus of ghosts from hell get to heaven and are told, you can stay as long as you want. Now, shortly, some solid people, some angels from heaven, come down out of heaven itself. See, the bus lands kind of on the outskirts, and they need to walk up into the mountains. And the angels come down to escort. It's almost as if a specific angel was sent to a specific ghost to escort them to come up into heaven. And the whole premise of the book, if you did read chapter 9, The whole premise of the book is right here. There is always something they insist on keeping, even at the price of misery. There is always something they prefer to joy. That is to reality. You see it easily enough in a spoiled child that would sooner miss its play and its supper than say it was sorry and be friends. The whole idea of this book is all these ghosts from hell go to heaven, and they're told they can stay as long as they give up the one thing that they're holding on to. Now, the bus was full. The bus that went from hell to heaven was full. Those of you who've read the book, how many on the bus stay? How many of them stay? One. One stays. Which means all the others do what? They go back rather than let go. You're counting, Sia. You're counting the author, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay. Good boy. He obviously stays. The author is C.S. Lewis himself. He puts himself in the story, and yes, I believe he stays. I'm sitting there saying, why would James say two? Why does James say two? Mo. Okay, I got it. But everyone else on the bus does what? Everyone else gets back on the bus and goes back to hell rather than let go of the one thing they're holding on to. So the brilliance of this book is he's going to push you into saying, are you holding on to that thing? Now, the restoration has allowed us to distinguish celestial, terrestrial. We saw from Mere Christianity, it's pretty easy to recognize when Christ has gotten rid of your celestial habits. The challenge is, are you willing to let go of your terrestrial habits? Do you even know what terrestrial habits are? And hence, I love the book, The Great Divorce. So, let me, with that introduction, introduce you to a classic example. I'm just going to read the story. It goes really quick. And you see if you can tell me what is it that he's holding on to? What is he holding on to that's going to cause him to stay in a lesser room? Before we do this, I just want to remind you of Elder Oak's last conference. It was last conference, right? Elder Oaks, in our last conference on the 3 degrees of glory, let me just remind you, said the following. We have a loving Heavenly Father who will see that we receive every blessing and every advantage that our own desires and choices will allow. You can have any kingdom you want as long as you let go of what's keeping you in another kingdom. So I would encourage you, as you read The Great Divorce, to keep a journal. And he's going to push your thinking. He's going to cause you to really think. Now, wait a minute. That's a lesser thing? The woman who loved her son? She loved her son. Why is she going back to hell? And this book is going to push you to say, what is the choice that's keeping you in a lesser kingdom? What are you holding on to? So tonight I just want to do two. I promised we'd do the painter tonight, so we'll do the painter tonight, which is absolute my favorite moment in the Great Divorce. But I want to start in chapter 4.
Is the painter the one you've been
Yes, the one I've told you. You remember the painter. We're going to get to the painter. But I want to start in chapter 4 kind of as an example of what is this book all about. So one of the guys on the bus, the author refers to as the big man. And he's kind of bullish. And as the solid people come down from heaven to escort the ghosts up, now, again, I am not going to use the language that C.S. Lewis, so allow me to say darned and gosh a whole lot in this, okay? Forgive me, I'm just not going to quote, especially in the chapel. Okay, so almost at once, I was followed by what I have called the big man. To speak more accurately, the big ghost. He in his turn, was followed by one of the bright people. "Don't you know me?" shouted the bright people. "Don't you know me?" he shouted to the ghost. I found it impossible not to turn and attend. The face of the solid spirit, he was one of those that wore a robe, made me want to dance. It was so jocund, so established in its youthfulness. "Well, I'm darned," said the ghost. "I wouldn't have believed it. It's a fair knockout. It isn't right, Len, you know. What about poor Jack? You look pretty pleased with yourself, but what I say is, what about poor Jack?" "He's here," said the other. "You will meet him soon if you stay." "But you murdered him." "Of course I did." "It's all right now." "All right, is it? All right for you, I mean, but what about the poor chap himself, laying cold and dead?" "But he isn't. I told you, you'll meet him soon. He sent you his love." "What I'd like to understand," said the ghost, "is what you're here for. As pleased as punch, you bloody murderer, while I've been walking the streets down there and living in a place like a pigsty all these years. That's a little hard to understand at first, but it is all over now. You will be pleased about it presently. Till then, there is no need to bother about it." "No need to bother about it? Aren't you ashamed of yourself?" "No. Not as you mean. I do not look at myself. I have given up myself. I had to, you know, after the murder. That was what it did for me. And that was how everything began." "Personally," said the big ghost with an emphasis which contradicted the ordinary meaning of the word, "personally, I'd have thought you and I to be the other way around. That's my personal opinion." "Very likely we soon shall be," said the other, "if you'll stop thinking about it." "Look at me now," said the ghost, slapping his chest. But the slap made no noise. "I've gone straight all my life. I don't say I was a religious man, and I don't say I had no faults. Far from it. But I've done my best all my life, see? I've done my best by everyone. That's the sort of chap I was. I never asked for anything that wasn't mine by rights. And if I wanted a drink, I paid for it. And if I took my wages, I'd done my job, see? That's the sort I was, and I don't care who knows it. It would be much better not to go on about that now." "Who's going on? I'm not arguing. I'm just telling you the sort of chap I was, see? I'm asking for nothing but my rights. You may think you can put me down because you're dressed up like that, which you weren't when you worked under me, and I'm only a poor man, but I gotta have my rights, same as you, see? Oh, no. It's not so bad as that. I haven't gotten my rights, or I should not be here. You will not get yours either. You'll get something far better. Never fear." "That's just what I say. I haven't got my rights. I always done my best, and I've never done nothing wrong. And what I don't see is why I should be put below a bloody murderer like you." Who knows whether you will be? Only be happy and come with me. What do you keep on arguing for? I'm only telling you the sort of chap I am. I only want my rights. I'm not asking for anybody's bleeding charity. Then do. At once. Ask for the bleeding charity. Everything is here for the asking, and nothing can be bought. That may do very well for you, I dare say. If they choose to let in a bloody murderer all because he makes a poor mouth at the last moment, then there's lookout. That's their lookout. But I don't see myself going in the same boat as you, see? Why should I? I don't want charity. I'm a decent man, and if I had my rights, I'd have been here long ago, and you can tell them I said so. The other shook his head. You can never do it like that, he said. Your feet will never grow hard enough to walk on our grass that way. You'd be tired out before you got to the mountains. It isn't exactly true, you know. Mirth danced in his eyes as he said it. What isn't true? Said the ghost sulkily. You weren't a decent man, and you didn't do your best. We, none of us were, and none of us did. Lord bless you, it doesn't matter. There's no need to go into it all now. You, gasped the ghost, you have the face to tell me I wasn't a decent chap? Of course, must I go on at all? I will tell you one thing to begin with. Murdering old Jack wasn't the worst thing I did. That was the work of a moment, and I was half mad when I did it. But I murdered you in my heart, deliberately, for years. I used to lie awake at nights thinking what I'd do to you if I ever got the chance. That is why I have been sent to you now, to ask your forgiveness and to be your servant as long as you need one, and longer if it pleases you. I was the worst. But all the men who worked under you felt the same. You made it hard for us, you know. And you made it hard for your wife, too, and your children. You mind your own business, young man, said the ghost. None of your lips, see? Because I'm not talking any prudence from you. I'm not taking any imprudence from you about my private affairs. There are no private affairs, said the other. And I'll tell you another thing, said the ghost. You can clear off sea. You're not wanted. I may be only a poor man, but I'm not making pals with a murderer, let alone taking lessons from him. Made it hard for you and your like, did I? If I had you back there, I'd show you what work is. Come and show me now, said the other with laughter in his voice. It'll be joy going to the mountains, but there will be plenty of work. You don't suppose I'd be going with you? Don't refuse. You will never get there alone. And I am the one who was sent to you. So that's the trick, is it? Shouted the ghost, outwardly bitter, and yet I thought there was a kind of triumph in his voice. It had been entreated. It could make a refusal, and this seemed to be kind of an advantage. I thought there'd be some darned nonsense. It's all a cliche. Click. It's all a click. All a bloody click. Tell them I'm not coming, see? I'd rather be damned than go along with you. I came here to get my rights, see? Not to go sniveling along on charity tied into your apron strings. If they're too fine to have me without you, I'll go home. It was almost happy now that it could, in a sense, threaten. That's what I'll do, it repeated. I'll go home. I didn't come here to be treated like a dog. I'll go home. That's what I'll do. Darn and blast the whole pack of you. In the end, still grumbling, but whimpering, also a little as it picked its way over the sharp grass, it made off. He went and got back on the bus. Now, tell me, what was he holding on to? There's a whole lot to this chapter. and this man. But tell me, what was the big ghost holding on to? What was he holding on to rather than letting go and moving upward and onward in advancement and getting into heaven? Tell me what you see is he holding on to. Pride is certainly one, but what form, Tim? What form is his pride in?
He won't take charity and he's like, I just want what I'm owed, and if that's charity, then he doesn't want it.
That is something you've got to process. I think a lot of Latter-day Saints get guilty of this. I will work my way to heaven. I just want what's mine. Now, doesn't that sound like a good thing? What is it that you have to let go of to get into the celestial room?
I think I took that away from when I read it, but also when President Oaks a couple years ago said, don't worry about as much about how other people are getting to the celestial kingdom. Worry about you being there. Like, you'll be surprised at who you see. And just that not holding other people back. Because, like, we deem that we're the judge. And I think it's interesting. He's like, you killed Jack, so you shouldn't be here. So just keeping people in those circles and not letting them change.
And he wove all of that into one character, didn't he? Is there an element of unwillingness to forgive here? I would rather go back on the bus and go to hell than be in heaven with you. There's an element. I would rather go back to hell than be in heaven with you. See what he's holding on to? Now, as much as I'd love to talk about that one, I just want to give that one as an introduction. Let's get to the painter. Turn to chapter 9. Now, chapter 9 is where George MacDonald, who is C.S. Lewis's C.S. Lewis. If you ask who influenced C.S. Lewis, like C.S. Lewis influences us, it was a man named George MacDonald. So George MacDonald comes down from heaven and talks to the main character, which is why I think C.S. Lewis is putting himself in this story. So C.S. Lewis is talking to his C.S. Lewis. His mentor.
Kind of reminds me of Dante's Inferno.
Yes, very much so. Dante's Inferno. So in chapter 9, this kind of all unravels. And George MacDonald comes down and starts to explain the whole thing to him. We've read several of these. I just wanted to remind you of this one. Heaven working backwards. That comes from chapter 9. There are, in the end, only two kinds of people, those that say, thy will be done, and those to whom God says. All of that comes from chapter 9, as George MacDonald and the main character kind of talk about what this whole thing is about. But then comes the story of the painter. So let's get there. You'll notice this natural gap. If you're flipping pages in chapter 9, you'll notice a natural gap, and then comes the story of the painter. Now, you tell me if this isn't us. As a teacher, I have thought about this painter so many times. I would invite you to have a very Lord is it I moment here. The painter doesn't even have a name, but he's mesmerized by the landscape. Oh my goodness. Painters have an eye for beautiful landscapes. And here he is in heaven. And he's mesmerized. And I'm going to start right here. I didn't color this one because it's the whole chapter. I should like to paint this. I shouldn't bother about that just at present if I were you. Look here, isn't one going to be allowed to go on painting? Looking comes first. But I've had my look. I've seen just what I want to do. Goodness, I wish I'd thought of bringing my things with me. The Spirit shook his head, scattering light from his hair as it did so. What sort of things? That sort of thing's no good here, he said. What do you mean, said the ghost? When you painted on earth, at least in your early days, it was because you caught glimpses of heaven in the earthly landscape. The success of your painting was that it enabled others to see those glimpses too. But here you are having the thing itself. It is from here that the messages came. There is no good telling us about this country, for we see it already. In fact, we see it better than you do. Then there's never going to be any point in painting here? Oh, don't say that. When you've grown into a person, it's all right. We all had to do it. There'll be some things which you'll see better than anyone else. One of the things you'll want to do will be to tell us about them, but not yet. At present, your business is to come. Come and see. He is endless. Come and feed. There was a little pause. Well, that'll be delightful, said the ghost presently in a rather dull voice. Come then, said the spirit, offering it his arm. How soon do you think I could begin painting, it asked. The spirit broke into laughter. Don't you see? You'll never paint at all if that's what you're thinking about, he said. What do you mean? Asked the ghost. Why, if you're interested in the country only for the sake of painting it, you'll never learn to see the country. But that's just how a real artist is interested in the country. No, you're forgetting, said the spirit. That was not how you began. Light itself was your first love. You painted only as a means of telling about light. Oh, that was ages ago, said the ghost. One grows out of that. Of course, you haven't seen my later works. One becomes more and more interested in paint for its own sake. One does indeed. I also have had to recover from that. Now listen to what? Just would you listen with your soul and apply it to whatever you do? Sing, paint, write, teach, perform, post. Whatever you do, hear what he's about to say. It was all a snare. Ink and catgut and paint were necessary down there. But they are also dangerous stimulants. Every poet and musician and artist and teacher and performer, every singer, but for the grace of God, is drawn away from the love of the thing he tells to the love of the telling. Till down in deep hell, they cannot be interested in God at all, but only in what they say about him. And it doesn't stop at being interested in paint, you know. They sink lower, become interested in their own personalities, and then in nothing but their own reputations. That paragraph might be one of the most stinging rebukes I ever read in all my life. The temptation to walk away from the love of the thing I tell to the love of the telling. Do you love the thing you tell? Or do you love the telling? When you stand right there and give a talk, do you love the thing you're telling? Or do you love the telling of it? There's the temptation. Everything you get good at, the temptation is to stop, loving the thing I tell and loving the telling.
I just think it's interesting because in you saying that, my perception of it is just, I want to share the glory of God versus, oh, glory to me, because I'm good at it. And there's nothing wrong with being good at something, but a matter of, when you start saying, well, how good I am, you start adding that comparison.
You stop saying, what a beautiful cathedral I built. And you start saying, what a beautiful cathedral I built. It's so tempting. I've watched it all my life. When you get good at something, pretty soon, it's the love of the telling.
Kind of reminds me of how, like, people make a lot of movies out there and also books, and I don't know. Sometimes it's like all of a sudden another artist takes up the movie and it's trash because they didn't actually love it. They love making it.
They love the telling. Beautiful. I don't think I'm much trouble in that way, said the ghost stiffly. That's excellent, said the spirit. Not many of us had quite got over it when we first arrived. But if there's any of that inflammation left, it will be cured when you come to the fountain. Well, what fountain is that? Oh, it's up there in the mountains, said the spirit, very cold and clear between two green hills, a little like Leth. When you have drunk of it, you forget. Now, remember our discussion on humility? You forget forever all proprietorship in your own works. You enjoy them just as if they were someone else's, without pride, without modesty. Oh, that'll be grand, said the ghost without enthusiasm. Well, come, said the spirit, and for a few paces, he supported the hobbling shadow forward to the east. Of course, said the ghost, as if speaking to itself, there'll always be interesting people to meet. Oh, everyone will be interesting. Yes, to be sure, I was thinking of people in our own line. Shall I meet Claude, Cezanne, or, well, sooner or later, if they're here. But don't you know? Well, of course not. I've only been here a few years, and all the chances are against my having run across them. There are a good many of us, you know. But surely in the case of distinguished people, you'd hear. But they aren't distinguished. No more than anyone else. Don't you understand? The glory flows into everyone and back from everyone like light and mirrors. But it's the light that's the thing. Do you mean there are no famous men in heaven? I'm going to let you think about that. Do you mean there are no famous people in heaven? They are all famous. They are all known, remembered, and recognized by the only mind that can have perfect judgment. Oh, of course, in that sense, said the ghost. Don't stop, said the spirit, making a lead for him to still forward. Well, one must be content with one's reputation among posterity, then, said the ghost. Oh, my friend, don't you know? Know what? You and I are already completely forgotten on earth. What? What's that? Exclaimed the ghost, disengaging its arm. Do you mean those darn neo-regionalists have won after all? Oh, Lord love you. Yes, said the spirit, once more shaking and shining with laughter. You couldn't get £5 for any picture of mine or even yours in Europe or America today. We're dead out of fashion. I must be off at once, said the ghost. Let me go. Darn it all, one has one's duty to the future of art. I must go back to my friends. I must write an article. There must be a manifesto. We must start a periodical. We must have publicity. Let me go. This is beyond a joke. And without listening to the spirit's reply, the specter vanished. Where'd he go? Back onto the bus to go back to hell. Now tell me what he couldn't let go of.
Well, I don't know. It's a thing that's been going on. Even my brother's been starting to think it too as well. As we started writing our stories, or go back to the stories that we've been writing, it felt like it wasn't really our own, that we were more half of the work being done with our work. It was really the Lord doing it, really.
That's an interesting perspective. Not one that many people have, right? So what's he holding on to? Tim, what's he holding on to?
He's only holding on to the thought that he knows better than people. And I also have a comment. I was sitting here thinking, that idiot, I wouldn't be like that. And then I thought, you know, the point of reading is to put yourself in character shoes and think, how am I like that? I think we have a tendency to do that is, this doesn't apply to me because I'm already over this kind of thing, when we're all like the painter in some way.
Yep. May I suggest, well, go ahead.
I think this kind of happened to me, that I was always a really good student, and then suddenly I wasn't, and then, wait, who am I? I need to be a good student. What else is there if I'm not a good student? Who am I? And he didn't know what to do or who he was if people, he couldn't rely on that boost. He didn't have enough confidence in himself, that he needed that boost of confidence that I'm going to buy your art, and who am I if people don't like me for my greatest talent?
He could not let go of what you think about me. Mm-hmm. And how many of you wouldn't admit it, but you really do care what people think? He couldn't let go of what others think about me. Now, that being said, can I point out four groups of people? Lehi's dream, there were four groups of people. In the Book of Mormon, 1 Nephi chapter 8, there are four groups of people. Let me just show you. Four times Lehi says, I saw numberless concourses of people. Nephi through Lehi. I saw numberless concourses of people. I beheld others. Second group. I saw others. Third group. Fourth group. He saw others. Four groups. One group goes straight to the building. One group never grabs the rod and never makes it to the tree. But two groups make it to the tree. Two of the four make it to the tree. One group stays, one does not. Two groups make it to the tree. One group stays, and one group does not. What is the difference between the people who make it to the tree and stay and the people who make it to the tree and don't? Let me show you the difference. As soon as this group partakes, tell me what they do.
They're ashamed.
Before they get ashamed.
Eat the fruit.
They partake and then? They look around. They partake and then they look around. They are looking at what you think about me. and they leave. That is a hard thing to let go of. Now, I don't mean being indifferent. I don't mean being careless. I don't mean stick it in your ear. I don't care what you know. That's different. Being belligerent about it is not the goal. Letting go, taking the fruit, and not caring what they think. They cast their eyes about. They're looking. They're worried. And they became ashamed of the fruit and they left. Can you paint and not worry about what people think about it? Can you stand here and give a great talk and not worry about what they think about your talk? Can you let that go? Let me show you who let that go. Way back in premortal life when we were choosing a redeemer. Now tell me what happened. When the Father said, I need a redeemer, what did everyone do? As soon as the Father said, I need a redeemer, what did we all do? We looked right at him, right? Every one of us looked right at him. We all knew who the Redeemer needed to be because of the character of Christ. Look what he did. I will go down and I will do thy work, and I won't care one bit about what they think about me. That's very hard to let go of. Because guess who stood up and said, I'll go do the work as long as all eyes are on me when I do it. That is an impossible thing to let go of. But I testify, you cannot walk into the celestial kingdom if you are looking around and care what they think. Thy will be done, and the glory be thine.
I think a lot of the reasons that people look around is because they want validation for the choice that they make.
Yep.
Everyone's like, am I right about whether I should have done this? And so if you take like the validation from others out and just have validation from yourself, then that shame and that comparison.
Validation, acceptance, shame avoidance, all of that is caring about what you think about me. I want to avoid shame. I want to do it in such a way that I'm not ashamed. Same idea. I am caring about what you think about me. Again, you got to balance that because I don't need to be belligerent about it. I don't need to be offensive about it. The Savior said, let your light so shine so that men may glorify God. The point is, I am not concerned about what you think about me. Let me read one thing, James, and I'll get to you. Rudyard Kipling wrote this beautiful poem. Now, it's about England. Bear with me. It's about England, but I'm going to replace England with Zion, okay? You'll allow me the liberty of doing that. Our Zion is a garden that is full of stately views of borders, beds, and shrubberies, and lawns and avenues, with statues on the terraces and peacocks strutting by. But the glory of the garden lies in more than meets the eye. For where the old thick laurels grow along the thin red wall, you'll find the tool and potting sheds, which are the heart of all. the cold frames and the hot houses, the dung pits and the tanks, the rollers, carts, and drain pipes with the barrels and the planks. There you'll see the gardeners and the men and prentice boys told off to do as they are bid and do it without noise. For except when seeds are planted and we shout to scare the birds, the glory of the garden, it abideth not in words. And some can pot begonias and some can bud a rose, and some are hardly fit to trust with anything that grows. But they can roll and trim the lawns and sift the sand and loam, for the glory of the garden occupieth all who come. Our Zion is a garden, and such gardens are not made by singing, "Oh, how beautiful," and then sitting in the shade, while better men than we go out and start their working lives at grubbing weeds from gravel paths with broken dinner knives. There's not a pair of legs so thin, there's not a head so thick, there's not a hand so weak and white, nor yet a heart so sick, but it can find some needful job that's crying to be done, for the glory of the garden glorifieth everyone. Then seek your job with thankfulness and work till further orders, if it's only netting strawberries or killing slugs on borders. And when your back stops aching and your hands begin to harden, you will find yourself a partner in the glory of the garden. Oh, Adam was a gardener, and God who made him sees that half a proper gardener's work is done upon his knees. So when your work is finished, you can wash your hands and pray for the glory of the garden, that it may not pass away. Let me work, Lord. Let me go back here. Let me do thy work, and all I will worry about is thy glory. I don't need theirs. I'll let it go. James.
I was just thinking about, like, with Easter and talking about Christ's final week and Peter's experience as well in saying, like, you know, I will die with thee, I will fight, I will, like, you know, and then he denies the Savior. Do you think part of that too is to help him understand? It's like, no, this isn't to your glory. This is to his, and, like, to kind of keep him in, prepare him for his further work.
Or even chopping the arm off and the ear off on the garden, right, Peter? This isn't what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
I think there was a moment of, tough guy, I'm going to save you. And Jesus said, no. No. And doing it his way is sometimes hard. I bear you my witness that one of the hardest things to let go of is what you think of me. Instead of, what does he think of me? Let that one go. Don't hold on to it. Don't worry about likes. Don't worry about the number of people who visit your page. You just go build the garden and worry about his glory. Don't fall out of love with the thing you tell and love instead the telling. Is my prayer in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.